Good evening, everybody. Welcome to my final series here in Toronto, Barriers to Belief. This series is dedicated in memory of my Zaidi, Dr. Miriam Herbert-Danziger, Mordechai Tzvi Pinchas Lechaya, and the inspiration for the series is based on a chapter in his book, Returning to Tradition. I brought a copy, and physical copy, somebody wants to leave through it if they're here. If not, well, I have it with me in general, so if you want to take a look at it, just come find me, and I probably have it on. So, the topic for tonight is going to be Jews and non-Jews and particular issues that people have in terms of remaining believing as Jews because of certain things that the Torah says about the interactions between Jews and non-Jews. So before we get started, so let's do a basic rundown for the various barriers we're running through this evening. And if you want to look it up in the book, if you have it, own a copy. Also, afterwards, I can send the PowerPoint afterwards if you'd like as well. Part of it's online, Google Books, but it is orderable on Amazon. Though officially it's out of print, but again, there are still copies on Amazon if you're looking to grab it. So, the opening line that I'd like to start with, again, quoting my grandfather, is: laws involving Jewish-Gentile relations present a major problem for Orthodoxy. So, right, so as far as what the problem is what we're going to try and boil out tonight. So, here. So before we actually get before I give everybody the list, so let me ask everybody. Let me try to see if I remember how to do the annotate function. Here we go. Okay, text. So, does anybody have any ideas for what they think might be problematic? But before I show what my grandfather suggested and what I'll suggest, what would you think is a problem?
Yayin Esef,
right? So Mark points out Yayin Esef, the fact that we cannot drink the wine of non-Jews for fear that it has been libated to a foreign deity. That is indeed a worry that we have, and it's also the law of Yayin Esef, as well as the law of Sam Yenam, which means that if you don't have wine that's been boiled, you can't have a non-Jew handle it. Okay, so anything else that people find problematic that I can think of? Anything else a little more violent, maybe?
Yichud?
Okay, there are some less not to be alone with certain individuals, especially non-Jews. So this applies. So an example of that would be you're not allowed to go to a non-Jewish barber unless he has a mirror for fear that he might slit your neck. That is a Gemara. There's also nowadays not really an issue because we're not afraid of them slitting your neck. And also, if you have a barber without a mirror, you should choose a better barber. There's a lot of them. So, but there's two in particular that have been a source of great animosity towards Jews over the millennia, and then those are ones that my grandfather points out. So the first one is that a Jew may not accept interest from another Jew, but he may take interest from a Gentile. And in fact, it appears to be encouraged. One of the main primary vocations of Jews for the last 1500 years or so has been being bankers because Christians were unable to lend money to one another, the Jews were. And there are many theories as far as that might be a very active cause for antisemitism. I see Gabrielle mentioned the treatment of Evan Ivry versus Evan Kanani. Yes, that is also something that would be problematic, right? The fact that we have different rules for a Jewish slave versus a non-Jewish slave. Excellent, right? So we'll get to more of the list, but for now let's focus on these two, and then we'll open again. I'll give my list, and if there's still more, feel free to pile it on. We will obviously not have time this evening to go through all the laws. So I'll mention some in passing, and we'll analyze primarily the two that my grandfather discussed. And hopefully the tools we see in those answers can hopefully help us answer the rest of them as well. So again, if you were looking for the verses, so I put one of the verses from Leviticus here about how if somebody's poor, you fill in their money and you can't charge interest, which appears, so there's a certain kindness that we send to our fellow Jews, but we wouldn't extend to the average non-Jew. Conversely, right, so that's one. And then the other one, which is a little more violent, nobody mentioned this one, which is, so anybody here work in a hospital? letter to your doctor, or there we go. See Dr. Denisov, right? So there is a law in the books that a Jew, that you're allowed to rescue a Jew on Shabbos, but in theory, you're not supposed to rescue a non-Jew, but you can because of Darkei Shalom.
Not because they have inherent worth.
It's an ancillary reason, basically, simply to protect ourselves. So the question is how is that possible? Right. So that's a pretty big question. Right. So the first one is relatively. So we'll address the first one first. We'll start easy, and then we'll go to the weighty question. So actually, we're going to pile on first. That's where my list is. So other challenging laws. So we mentioned several. Right, some that are rabbinic, some of which are biblical, to the difference of laws for Jews and non-Jews. So there's also, again, we mentioned usury, right, and interest laws, right, because they're not our brothers. So therefore, we're allowed to be mean to them, right? There's also the general prohibition of intermarriage, which might be a little bit easier to explain because good luck trying to maintain a marriage with different values, even if it was not directly biblically prohibited. There's also a lot of prohibitions of rabbinically on food, which is why even though you're like, oh, it should be fine if I were to go to a vegan restaurant in Bethany and Hampshire, the answer is that basically every single one of the rabbinic prohibitions to prevent us from intermarrying through food would still apply in a vegan restaurant. For more on that, please Google it online. You'll see a whole list of reasons why, what can be the problem there. Okay. And then there's the violating Shabbat to save a Jew's life, but not a Gentile's life, as well as some other ones that I was hoping somebody mentioned, that we have a mitzvah to destroy Amalek, to wipe out any remnant of the Amalek nation, as well as the seven Canaanite nations that were also commanded to wipe out. Right, and then there's also, this was actually asked by one of my students, how can we say Shalos Ani Goy, starting off our days saying, I thank God I'm not a non-Jew. Like, how can we say that? So the last one I'm leaving off specifically for next week because it dovetails very well with Shlosa and Isha. So we'll have a larger discussion when we discuss attitude towards women next week, and we'll see that that's we'll relate to that. Yes.
How about you can't visit some of the most gorgeous architectural places in the world?
Yes, you can't visit architecture that's directly related to idolatry.
And some of them are those gorgeous.
Right, they are. They, right, let's say going
to. How do you say they're gorgeous?
Right, going, go. Yes, this, yes, can you say they're gorgeous? Right, a lot of artwork, a lot of, you know, to tunes of billions of dollars towards various temples over the millennia.
Yeah, that you can't admire them from afar.
Correct. I'm not supposed to look at the pictures either. It's right because it's for idolatrous purposes. So we'll have to address what's so bad about idolatry to answer that. That'll answer a lot of these questions. Actually, figuring out what's wrong with idolatry, as well as figuring out what's behind each of these various prohibitions. So let's get to it then. Right? Again, so we're not getting to Shalos Ani Goy yet. We'll get to all the Shalos next week. Anybody has any other challenging laws they want to enter? They want to submit now?
When was the paper written?
This was written in 1980. It was published in 1989.
So I would suggest in the 30-odd years since then, prohibition to intermarry, and maybe we haven't intermarried, but many people, almost everybody has somebody who has in their family. So how do you deal with that?
How to deal with intermarriage is a good question.
How do you treat the person?
That is an excellent question, which require a much longer conversation, which is a very sensitive topic that I do not have time for to discuss. I'm happy to discuss it afterwards, but definitely that would take up the entirety of our time. So I'm going to simply say it is a giant mess. And if you want to see more examples of how you can handle it, you can look at, say, for Ezra. Well, that's the way to handle it nowadays or not. The answer is probably not, but it's a very complicated situation.
I have a vague memory about abortion and forming abortions on Jewish doctors are not Jews.
Right. The question of doing abortions on Jews versus non-Jews is also something that comes up. And, you know, is there a difference between the status of a Jew and a non-Jew in that sense and the technicalities therein? Again, discussing the entirety of the topic of Jews and non-Jews is definitely beyond my meaning. Also, to explain the whole issue behind abortion, at what point for Jews versus non-Jews also is a complicated discussion that is I'm happy to send you articles on and share them on the topic. I believe my grandfather wrote one on that also that was written six years ago, so I'm not sure how accurate it is nowadays. But So, but yes, that is also the case there.
Sorry, I'm going to pile on one more thing.
Yeah.
I've heard from Jews who've said, and we've got inanimate objects, vegetation, animals, goyim, and Jews. So are goyim a lesser form of life than Jews?
Okay, so good. So Mark is pointing out, hopefully you can hear. If you can't, I'll repeat everything. So Mark said the question of the various levels, where they're entirely level lower in terms of life form than Jews are, which we will discuss that later. Yes, that is also mentioned. Yes.
I have a question.
Yes.
What is the difference? I've heard the word Abba or Ava, and between Ava and Darche Shalom.
Right. So for our purposes, we're going to treat them as being roughly the same thing, because Darche Shalom is ways of peace in order for things to become peaceful, and Ava is to not directly generate enmity. So they're very closely intertwined. There are very many excellent shirim that discuss the intricacies, but for purposes of tonight's discussion, we'll treat them as roughly the same thing. Meaning that they are a rabbinic enactment that work in similar ways. Whether or not they're not necessarily all caught in the same cases or not, or could be used independently or not, is a different discussion. But we'll get there also. Okay, so now we have a lot of questions. So as I mentioned before, we will only be getting to two primary questions, hopefully, which will hopefully answer most of the rest, but will not necessarily answer all of them. So first thing before we actually answer the questions is we have to figure out, well, why does it bother us? So this is a question for the four, either online or in person. In person will get first choice, and then online, right? So why does it bother us when we hear these things about non-Jews? That there's a different law between Jews and non-Jews.
Because we don't live in the shtetl anymore, where we're isolated from completely. We live in a society where we encounter them every day.
Right, we encounter them every day. Like, you're going to be meeting, like, they're our friends. Like, how can we be so cruel to them?
Right, extending that, there are other human beings, God's creations, you know, where no samples can be the void too, and just, I don't know, it's just, to me, it's a moral ethical issue.
A moral ethical issue. Very good, right? Okay, so you got a moral ethical issue, common sense, how could you be mean to somebody who's right there, who you know? Good. Any other suggestions?
We know how we were treated historically as lesser humans, so we want to show we're better.
Right. We know, right, love your neighbor like you love yourself. So if you happen to have a neighbor that's a non-Jew, you would not want him to do what non-Jews have done in the past to the Jews, because you know how badly that turned out. Okay. Good. So anybody online have any other additional thoughts? Okay.
We don't want to cause anti-Semitism.
Okay. Elaine's pointing out we're worried about causing anti-Semitism, right? As in, if we are, have these laws in the books that are against non-Jews, that's a very easy stepping stone for them to decide to have a pogrom or try and kill us. So also an issue, but they don't really necessarily need a reason to do that, unfortunately. They make up reasons that are unrelated to these. If you look at the history of riots, it's unrelated. Also, general race riots and other riots. Yeah, my grandfather wrote on those as well, that it very rarely has anything to do with any actual real reason. It's generally based on other factors that are completely irrelevant to a good reason, unfortunately.
It sounds like we're mostly thinking about Christianity, but we've had issues with Muslims over the years too, and the way we've been treated. Muslim
Correct. It applies, again, Christians, Muslims, even if they're not Jewish, even if they're not one of the Abrahamic religions. Also, we've had issues over the millennia. Romans were definitely pagan, right? All of them at various points have had their attempt at killing us, unfortunately. So, right, so all these things bother us. So now just to go over some quotes that'll hopefully help. So you'll see Rabbi Mendel Weinbach quoted extensively in the section. He was one of the co-founders of Or Sameach, which is a yeshiva for Baalei Tshuva, meaning for people who are Jewish or turn to religion. So they would study at his yeshiva, and my grandfather interviewed him quite a bit to discuss, issues and how he handled them when people asked him these type of questions. So, right, so when you see the answers here, right, so the answer that given by Rabbi Weinbach Zichrono Lebracha, is exactly what Dr. Enoso mentioned, right? That these are people with a highly developed sense of ethics and morality, and therefore these questions really bother them, right? It's straightforward. We all get that. So now, so there were other options that we're not going to take because we're Orthodox. So my grandfather lays out here. So they're not problems for Reform Jews. You can simply say that they are the primitive conceptions of morality of an earlier age. So that's not something we say for Orthodox because we assume the Torah is timeless. Conservatives attempt to explain the, meaning conservative movement, attempt to explain these laws in terms of the prevailing social and economic conditions at the time they were laid down. Right, so that's basically doing more relativism based on the time period, which also not going for us. Torah is timeless. But for the Orthodox, whom laws are eternal and unchanging, they present a problem. So now we're doing it from the Orthodox perspective because we don't want to blow up the rest of Torah to solve an ethical problem. So now how do we solve it? So mentioned by Mark was the question of the Kabbalistic levels, which is the one that you should never, ever, ever tell somebody. Ever. Ever. Right? So the most problematic answer in terms of universalistic values are offered by those whose theory of soul suggests that some have holier souls or derive from higher divine sparks than others. But as already pointed out in earlier chapters of my grandfather's book, discussion of the soul is part of the hidden knowledge, the nistar of Kabbalah, and that is only alluded to. Generally, it's not necessarily taken to mean exactly what you think it means, and also it's not necessarily meant to be learned by most people. Such a position is to be acceptable to those who believe in reincarnation and the progression of souls from lower to higher levels through continued rebirth. A view not inconsistent with the teachings of Far Eastern religions, agnostic and mystical Christianity. This perspective, however, and to a lesser extent, the Juristic one, still leave communities for the most part drawn very tightly, with only a few, the critical sparks, as the chosen, and the rest of lesser importance. Furthermore, the more countercultural we stand, the more tightly have the boundaries between we and they been drawn, the smaller community of the we has been. So, problem with saying that, oh, you know, Jews are something special and unique to the point of knocking out others is that that becomes very challenging on many levels. Well, you have to understand what that meant in terms of the Kabbalistic sense, which is itself a hard thing to understand. And also, Kabbalah contradicts itself. What does it mean? Do you necessarily need to take it as being true? Many would say you don't. There are different opinions in Kabbalah as well, all of which is relevant, which would be a reason why you should not say this. In addition to that, this also goes against other explicit psukim, as well as explicit gemaras is another thing that's also worthy mentioning. And the special problems come up. So therefore, my main approach in terms of this general Kabbalistic view and rebirth is simply to say no. Right, and then you can say this, but you should never. But this is not one that you should ever recommend to anybody because it creates so many more problems than necessary, both in terms of general theology and how Judaism works and how life works. And it's more or less a nuclear bomb to try and deal with an issue that has much better answers that will not lead to unraveling of much other bigger concepts by usage of them. But again, this is one that you may hear. But this is not one that I would ever conscience using, and I don't agree with in the slightest.
Well, even in the Kuzari, you have Ali who said that the Jews have a super gene.
Right. So the Kuzari mentioned that the Jews have some sort of super gene, but also realized that the question is whether or not this is something that everybody has access to or not. And a lot of the Kabbalistic views sound like it's not something inherent to non-Jews, and it also seems to sound like there's no way for non-Jews to have a share of the world to come, which many Gemaras point to that being the case, and with me to be right to Gentile. There's a lot of things that break if we take that go down that road, so we're not going to go down that road. Also, because genetic markers, that the making of a Jew is not in his genetics, it's generally in his belief, as you can tell by the fact that Jews are, they're Jews from literally every single genetic, demographic, and ethnographic in the world. For more on that, that's a good question on how that occurred.
So with respect, just because you find this uncomfortable doesn't mean that we can wish it away.
We can't wish it away, but as far as do I find this answer satisfactory, the answer is no, because I in general don't understand what that means to begin with. A lot of these things that are necessary in order for those to work, such as belief in reincarnation, regression of souls, etc., run in the fly in the face of things such as reward and punishment, and you know, a concept of free will, and other things that are generally viewed as, you know, some of the primary forms of belief that Jew has to hold. So in order to get those, to stick those into, as in, there are, before we even mention the differing levels, there's many other things that are in the way. So I have to mention it because people often say it, but as far as do I think this is a good answer, the answer is no. And I think that, that this is an answer that will, as I said, cause more problems than it's worth, as well as both in terms of for the person, as well as theologically, has many issues as well. Again, but it is an answer offer, so I can't pretend it doesn't exist. I'm simply stating that I don't like it because I don't really follow the Kabbalah behind it or the other ramifications that occur as a result. Okay? So, again, you can use this one, but it'll, yeah, very risky to use it. Also, generally, somebody comes to this for this question, you tell them this, that'll make them not want to be religious anymore. Because generally, the person is coming because they have an issue, they're trying to figure out how to deal with, you know, relating to the Torah while also knowing that they have a very nice friend who's not Jewish, right? And they're like, wait, now what? So this will not help them. It'll only make them not want to be religious. So that's why I would never answer this to an individual who had said, who asked any of those problems. Okay. Now, continuing on, that was the potentially the worst answer. Now, here are some other bad answers that you shouldn't use. As before, so that wasn't specifically called a bad answer by my grandfather, but I, as you can tell, called it a really bad answer because I really don't like it. But here, so what is another option you could say? It is not satisfying to respond, the laws are no longer applicable. That Orthodox Jewish law today requires a violation of Shabbat law to save the life of the Gentile because of Darkei Shalom, to promote peace between Jew and Gentile, for that still leaves the unanswered question of the ethic of the law. Even if you say practically there's no difference, but the reality is like, but it's on the books. So why, right? Even if I practically get rid of it, it's like, okay, but that sounds like you're just, you know, not ideally, but it's there. So that's not necessarily going to satisfy. Well, don't worry. We'll that answer we can deal with a little bit, but going through the other ones that are bad, nor is it meaningful to argue that other faiths make distinction between the faithful and infidels that are far more shocking, that call for the faithful to kill and destroy the unbelievers. That's been us many times, right? So that position is of little comfort for the Orthodox Jewish believer. It reflects the relativistic position of modern religious and anthropological thought, not the position of one who believes that his or her religion is truly divinely revealed and without flaw. Right? This only works if you're saying, like, see, we're just like them or no worse than them, but that doesn't actually make you good or in the right or divine. It just means that, like, well, hey, he did something bad, therefore what I did is okay. So again, if anybody tried to use this as a defense in court, they'd be thrown out. So we shouldn't be using it as in our moral defense either, because it's a terrible answer. Okay. Nor can one suggest that the rabbis erred in their interpretation of the law. In the framework of rabbinical Judaism, the rabbis of the Talmud do not err in the interpretations of the law. Interpretation would be true even if contradicted by some divine sign or miracle. For more on that, see the story of Tanur Shachnai and many other examples in the Gemara where miracles are relevant compared to the law. Conceding error once the majority decision has been accepted by the community or committed is theologically impossible and would raise the most weighty of questions about the nature of the authority of the Jewish law. In fact, this concept of authority is the heart of the difference between Orthodoxy and other wings of Judaism. Right, so we can't simply say that the rabbis made a mistake and they're wrong and therefore wipe it out, because that implies that the entirety of rabbinic Judaism is basically a farce, and we try not to erase the rest of Judaism to solve an ethical problem. So this is similar to the, as opposed to the issue of the Kabbalistic one, which can also lead to destroying it, but from a different way. That's more of a theological destruction. This is a functional destruction. Hope that's helpful. I know it's confusing, but we could argue about each given point about how rabbinic Judaism works, but for now we'll take this as being the case for the ease of convenience and time. Okay, so those are the bad answers that will most likely not satisfy people for various reasons, and therefore I would never conscience telling any of these ones. But in terms of saving one of them, we could save a little bit in terms of the Shulman Abel. Right, so that one can be solved by phrasing it slightly differently. It's called termed by Bar Nicholson as creating a just and moral society. Right? This is basically, so the rabbis were given the power, and in order to do so deliberately, then it was known that certain law, if you were to open the Torah and try and live based on exactly what's written in the text, you couldn't. It requires interpretation, it requires exegesis, it requires traditions in order to make sense. And that, and the power of interpretation was then given over to the rabbis, right? So, right, all over Moshe Rabbeinu, from person to person, that's how the law was passed down. So we have that ability to reinterpret laws to a certain degree. So therefore, part of the mission of Jews as a whole is also in terms of, and the rabbis, again, have the limitation on this is, there are many limitations on this, but overall, the idea is that when the rabbinic enactments are not an accident, and in fact, many say that they actually have biblical significance, meaning that they can uproot even biblical laws. For what, how that works out, what that means is a good question, but we'll just leave that as it is for now. So now, if we continue, so in terms of an example of where we see that being applied in our case, so here's the unique formulation of the Rambam in regards to Darkei Shalom and how it's being used. So we'll go with the, we'll do the Hebrew and the English, because I realize that there are various sources overall that I quoted tonight, so let's go with an actual Torah source, we have it. Okay. So, we treat, it appears to me, meaning the Rambam, that we treat the resident convert as we would a Jew, and as with respect and loving kindness. Because we are commanded to support and sustain him. Shenemar says in the Torah, the strangers in your gates you shall give so that he may eat. And our sages have said that we do not double shalom shalom in referring to non-Jews, but we would say it to a ger toshav. Right. So the ger toshav is to explain who it is. It's somebody who decides they want to live in Israel and abide by certain of the mitzvot, namely the seven Noahide mitzvot for sure, and then the debate as to how many of the actual mitzvot they have to take on. And that's the entire debate amongst the various Rishonim. So we will, rabbinic commentators, so we will leave that aside. The point being is that this is somebody who removed themselves from the category of idolater towards believing in God. And so for him, right, he has a different status. And then the Rambam continues. So he continues saying that, Afilu ha'akum, tivu chachamim, levaker kolehem, v'likbor metehem, imitei Yisrael, fornes aniyehem, and as far as the word Darkei Shalom, the ways of peace, so because of that, even somebody who's an idolater, the rabbi commanded us that we have to make sure to visit their sick, bury their dead, and make sure to properly support their poor individuals the same way we support our own. This is based on the verse in Tehillim, Tov Hashem l'kol v'rachamav l'kol ma'asav. God is good to all to everyone, and his kindnesses extend to all of his creations. And also says in Proverbs, her ways are ways of pleasantness, and all her paths are peace. Right, so the interpretation of this and the expansion of Darkei Shalom here is the Rambam's clearly associating it with God's goodness, as well as the Derechei Derechei Noam, meaning the phrase that the laws and paths of the Torah have to be good and just. Right, so that means that it can't be anything more than that. It can't be simply that it's, the rabbi had to tack on to save themselves. No, this was always the intent. This is simply the rabbis following the ways of God. It's not that they took it out of nowhere. They are doing it based on divine missive, and simply God handed them the keys and said, it is now up to you to have the laws set in a just and moral way. So this would be the way to save the issue I mentioned before of saying Darkei Shalom. I mean, it's underlying a more general idea. For instance, this is also put forth by Rav Lichtenstein. It's also put forth by Rav Unterman, who was one of the previous Rav Rashis. He was in the 50s and 60s. 50s, yeah, 50s and 60s. I'll have put for some of Jews as well. In terms of explaining why you're allowed to save non-Jews on Shabbat, again, explain that it's not simply rabbis covering themselves, rather it is an ideal.
Okay, but let's say a third of Canadian society are atheists, and they're not worshiping idols, but maybe they swear God because they're angry and they're anti-religion. So they're not keeping the 70s of B'nai Noach.
So we're gonna get there. As far as what is the status of an idolater or non-idolater and why, so we're gonna get there. So, but first, let's go through some other answers that hopefully get us to that point. So, first thing is the difference between laws that are being nice to our fellow Jews versus ones that are seemingly cruel to others. So, for instance, this is the case of usury, which has been a source of a lot of anti-Semitism over the millennia. That's a relatively easy explanation, right? This is Rabbi Weinbach points out that the issues of we'll skip it in the interest of time, but basically economically it makes no sense to land people things for free for extended periods of time. You only do that to your good friends and family. For anybody else, it makes no economic sense. Same thing with giving of loans and a lot of other types of charity, right? Economically, it makes no sense to simply let people have indefinite loans with no limits and that you every 7 years you would undo them makes no sense from any responsible economic financial model. So it only makes sense, again, you would do it for your brother, for your immediate family, but beyond that, you'd be like, no. So therefore, it's not, so to not extend the kindness to the non-Jew is not surprising because you wouldn't extend it to your neighbor either, only if you were really good friends and really liked the guy. But otherwise, you'd be like, no, I'm not giving you my brand new car. Sorry, that's not happening. Okay.
But wait a second, you said even earlier, is the Torah giving us advice? About how, or is it requiring?
It's requiring us to be kind to our fellow Jew.
No, it's requiring us to take interest. I've heard it is.
I mean, yes, you can say that, but again, requiring taking interest is simply good financial advice, as opposed to the not having interest is basically giving charity. So it's saying, so it would be like, here's good financial advice, but you should probably be nice to your brother. It's very different than, for instance, if you. Services rendered, you should be paid for. That's generally considered to be a normal thing in society, all societies. So that's to solve that. So assuming kindnesses to your fellow Jew does not mean that you're being mean to the non-Jew. That's simply you're being nice to your brother, right? And just Jews have an extended family. And again, that's why you would do so. Okay? And as far as actually charging interest, the answer is that Jews 100% do charge interest to each other thanks to the works of the Tosafists. Namely, Rabbeinu Tam, who instituted the Hesher Iska, which is a way to turn it instead of being a loan into a business venture, which then in turn means that you can't basically loan with interest, and that's how many businesses and loans run nowadays. So therefore, even Jews give interest to Jews at this point. So also, don't be angry at us for that. It's just like because it basically got nixed. Yes. The way the Hesher Iska works is that the lender, instead of it being I'm lending you money, it's more of investing in your future. And therefore you can give me back money in my shared venture capitalist space. Early venture capitalism. That helps. Okay. So now another option, the answer that is given is might be the playing up of the importance of the Torah. Which this is the answer initially given by Rabbi Weinbach. So he answered by stressing the holiness of the Shabbat. So confronted with this issue by Baal Teshuva, who insistently beseeched him for an answer, Rabbi Weinbach replied, "How would you feel if you were the one assigned to drop an atomic bomb in Hiroshima? You knew that the war effort and the lives of tens of thousands of countrymen depended on you, but you also knew that tens, maybe hundreds of thousands of people would be killed and many more times that maimed by the bomb. You would hesitate. Well, violating Shabbat is like dropping that atomic bomb. The Shabbat is so holy, so important, you can violate it with impunity. You cannot violate it with impunity, even if the reasons are terribly important." And this answer seemed to satisfy the Baal Teshuva, who decided to remain at the yeshiva. This is a story from the 70s. Okay, so he was happy. But many of us would say, wait, but we do violate it for the Jew, so I still don't get it, right? You'd be upset by this answer not being fully satisfying and solving our problem at all. And you're just like, Torah is important. It's like, okay, but so as far as why that particular student was happy with it, so my grandfather suggests the question of why Shabbat violated is still there. So rather, it's a terrible moral dilemma with another big moral dilemma. So whether the equation is fair is separate entirely. Perhaps all the student wanted was to know that the teacher was also sensitive to this moral problem, made uncomfortable by it. Students really didn't have a good answer. Judaism is full of questions as well as answers. Not all of which are satisfactory, but the important part is that you attempt to find an answer, whether or not it satisfies you. And Jews are happy to live with questions, and in fact, they love it. So that could be the answer, that you simply didn't find a good answer to the question. But of course, I would like a better answer, and there are better answers to be had. So let's get to them. So the better answers that my grandfather suggests is, right, who are non-Jews, right? Who are the people that we were saying that you would, you know, not save on Shabbos? So the term used in the Gemara is akum, ovdei kochavim, literally idolaters, idol worshippers. So therefore, modernists who follow by Maimonides' teaching, we're going to quote him a little bit earlier, a little more closely, sometimes answer the question by pointing out that these laws refer not to Gentiles, but specifically to star worshippers, a precise legal category, meaning those who deny the existence of deity, meaning of God, who practice no law and no justice, and whose ways are cruel and murderous. Jews and dark religions, meaning Christianity and Islam, do not fall into this category, as you could argue the religion that is having no religion. The case of the Gentile who is not helped is therefore a legal category, but concretely an empty one. It exists primarily to teach a lesson about religious values rather than about how to conduct oneself in relation to others. Halacha does require that the Gentile be rescued, even if this involves the desecration of the Sabbath. Right? So at the end of the day, the reality is that the pagans that we're referring to don't exist anymore. So when you had a corrupt pagan 2,000 years ago, that would be the case. World probably better off without him. But nowadays, that's not the case. Right? So this is stated clearly in many early sources, seen in the Babylonian Talmud, such as in Kulin, Rot and Rashi there, in the Gemara and Kiddushin, as well as Tosot there, as well as the Gemara of Orazara. But that's 2a, and as well as by the Meiri, who we will look into more in depth. And again, there's an article by Jacob Katz that discusses, and many others since him, again, that was 60 years ago, who explained whether the extension of this and how to utilize it. So just to go through in terms of Rabbi Nachman Meiri's view, so his basic view is that there is no such thing as an idolater anymore, really, right? So many have been wondering, so there's a lot of laws we mentioned earlier in terms of things related to idolaters, some of which clearly were referencing this thing known as Christianity. Yet for some reason, if you take a look around, you realize that we don't really follow many of them anymore. And the question is, well, why on earth not? Right? A lot of these things that like you people haven't heard of, a lot of the laws of Machal Yaakov, and you're like, well, why haven't we? And why don't we follow some of these laws? Like we open Masechet Avodah Zarah, you're like, wait, we don't do any of these things. So the question is, why not? So Rabbi Nachman Meiri, again, this is written in the 13th century. So he writes, says as follows. Many have been seen wondering that nowadays no one is actually careful about these things at all. And we already explained that the essential intent of the book about which the nations circles around, such as it refers to their days of worship, meaning Yemei Dehem, that where you can't do business that 3 days before, 3 days afterwards, which would mean that you basically can't do business with a Christian in that case, because 3 days before, they have their 7th day as a holy day, so you're forever stuck. So there we're worried about them basically taking, you gave them the item and they're like, yay, and they go praise their pagan gods because of your actions. But that was the case but that they were not fenced in by the current way of the Hebrew word is before they were not Shalohayu Bidurot, Bidarkay Adatot. They were not part of the fenced in by ways of religion. Meaning they didn't have ancient religions were inherently corrupt, and that's part of the problem, which we'll discuss a little bit more after finishing the Erie. Right? So everybody else was always very much following and worshiping idols and stars and other forces because of all those like it are the essential point of idolatry, as we explained. Right? So the issue is, if you're actually an idolater, there's something inherently wrong with idolatry, and that's what makes them bad. But if you're clearly not idolatrous, to save our issue of dealing with, you know, the atheists and the average individual and the average Christian or Muslim nowadays, as well as many other religions as well, because they're not, strictly pagans. right? Not idolaters. When you're not idolaters, then there is what to be said. So, and in any event, regarding the suspicion of violating a Shabbat or suspicion of forbidden foods and drink, such as Yayin Nesa, which I mentioned earlier, Rain Samianim, which is related, and other similar prohibitions, they're forbidden in benefit or in eating. And what is the reason behind a lot of those things that's left, even though they might not be adulterated anymore, but there's still always a fear of intermarriage. And therefore, all nations are equal in that. As in, we don't want you to intermarry out of Judaism for many reasons. And therefore, that's the main the driving force behind these. And that's understandable to basically to most people at this point, right? Why intermarriage is bad. And therefore, that's much easier to conscience than the than everything else, because it's also made from the fact that we can stay a part of Judaism as opposed to leaving it is different than the negative ones towards other nations. And now these words should be very upright to your heart, and you don't have to worry about the element about every element explained. Rather, you will decide which fits for ancient peoples and which for all of them, and you will now understand. So, to summarize the Meiri, the non-idolaters, you know what idolatry is and why it's bad. Use your common sense now, and you'll know that, again, make sure that you don't end up accidentally intermarrying with them. But as far as everything else goes, there's still what that you can do, and it'll be fine. So, and as far as, again, a short list of Jewish history is the next slide. So, idolatry being fundamentally corrupt, so we can go through it in the various generations. We can start from the time of Noah. We can go to right with the son Ham, who ends up taking advantage of his father, as well as the son Canaan, and all the abominations done by the Canaan, as well as the Canaanite nations, followed by the action, wicked actions of Paro, the wicked actions of Sodom, all the idolaters, by the way, Shem and his rape, and his covering up, and his raping of Dinah, the cover up by his father Hamor, again, all idolaters, the corrupt actions of Pharaoh. Basically, you could find a list of non-Jews in the Torah, and as well as Tanakh, and you count on one hand the ones that are actually good, as opposed to on the, you know, the other, you know, thousands of pentateuchs, you must have to count them all. That would not be the case. So, as in the general rule is that if somebody is idolatrous, then it therefore corrupts their souls and their actions as well, which is in turn why idolatry is so bad. And then it gets back to the original point of what's really bad about idolatry is also remember that because they're inherently so corrupt, that God deems them worthy of death. And also looking at their actions, you'd probably also want some death. Anyways, even if you had been a religious atheist, a lot of those actions you see put forth by the idolaters are so bad that you'd also see fit to the death, such as an example of this considered to be relatively commonplace in the ancient world is something called child sacrifice, practiced throughout the Middle East, Europe, Africa, as well as in the Americas, at various points, child and human sacrifice being done for purposes of magical purposes. Again, whether it worked or not, or didn't work, is not the point. The point is that they were all doing it. And that is an example that you can, a reasonable perception you can get from following idolatry, as we saw happened in literally every single culture the world over. Yes, eventually the world, figured out it was wrong, but again, that was the case for several thousands of years in various places all throughout the world.
But what does it mean for contemporary Canada? Indigenous religions, is that considered idolatry? Do they have multiple gods?
The answer is not really.
And why?
I mean, you have to, well, A, you have to look at A, what their the level of their religiosity and what they have to do with the religions, and whether or not that actually lines up them being idolatrous in the same sense, as well as the same perversions that have been done. And if the answer is yes, and that's a problem, but if the answer is functionally no, and actually most of them aren't necessary. If you are idolatrous in the way, and you're, for instance, there are many, let's say, if you were to say what is religion right now in, let's say, China, technically they are pagan by their religion system, but functionally they're more communists or socialists in their religion than they are their actual religion. So then you'd have to figure that out, and that's a good question, but generally most, because they're not, again, corrupt in that same way, going down towards those, and like, meaning, get examples of the terrible things done by idolaters in Tanakh is not what they're doing. So in the question of, again, how do you categorize religion, I am not going to, again, know when you see it, as Miri pointed out, you'll know, if you look at religion, it looks like they're doing things that are making deserving of death. It's a different thing than if they're not necessarily doing so. Yes, Elaine?
Is the Lord of Zara equal idolatry?
Not necessarily, but for now we'll say yes. Avodah Zarah means strange worship. Idolatry means worship of idols and other forces. Meaning Avodei Kohanim, meaning literally idol worshippers, star worshippers. So exactly what falls into that category is a good question, which is why you don't get categorized any religion as idolatrous is a weighty thing to say. But many religions would not fall under that, and that would be, or societies wouldn't fall under it, because again, most societies nowadays are secularized. By that I mean basically all of them are, and very rarely do they make decisions based on religion, for better or for worse.
It's like you shouldn't go on into a church because
they're religious. Correct.
So they're not idolaters.
So the answer is that Meiri is a. It is considered to be death in regards to that, in terms of entering their actual place of worship. But as far as their treatment of the non-Jews, that's much more accepted. Of non-Jews is much more accepted. As in, to go to their actual place of worship is still viewed as extremely problematic, because it still is, when you look at it, it's still based, also the question of, it might not be adulterous for them, but adulterous for you, in regards to Christianity. As in, this is the question, but that's a separate discussion that is, separate thoughtful discussion to be had. Okay. So now to wrap up. So let's go through basically what we've covered so far. So bad approaches. So we mentioned that Jews are simply better inherently. We said that was bad and dangerous for many reasons. We mentioned the fact that maybe just because God said so, which doesn't necessarily satisfy anybody, because you have to that comes from a much stronger point of belief. Rabbis are wrong. That's a problem because, well, then you may as well throw out Judaism as we know it, and therefore that's not a good answer. Other religions are bad too. Also, not a good answer, right? Another option is that we said it could be good, not, which is sometimes satisfying, sometimes not, is the question, the use of Darkei Shalom and Eva, of the concept of path of peace or fear of enmity of non-Jews, therefore taking the teeth out of it, so essentially it doesn't really exist anymore. And we mentioned that it only works if this is in our rabbinic ideal and missive, which is put forth by Yann Rabban and others. But again, if it's not, then it sounds like you're just doing apologetics, and that'd be a problem. So that one is a maybe. But as far as other ones that are workable, so one is that it's not necessarily that we're any meaner to them, because for instance, we would for instance put to death a Jewish idolater. It's just that we're often more kind to our, let's say, the case of usury, we are kinder to those within our group. But again, for instance, like somebody is an idolater, they're Jewish, we still do kill them. So that's not really different from Jew and non-Jew, to be fair. An emphasis on this job of sanctity is offered by some, but we mentioned also by emphasizing the Torah can be problematic because it doesn't necessarily justify the conundrum. It simply can equate with a bigger moral issue. We mentioned the idea of the Eri and others, namely that idolater is not the same as a Gentile, and therefore it's an important distinction that can save a lot of things. Again, who you put into the category of idolater, my goal tonight was to remove people from it, not put it in, because I do not want to, I'm not a judge seeking to put in anybody, to condemn anyone right now, so therefore I'm going to not do that. Okay, and then last but not least, the most important part is, what is the real answer to all this, is that you might not have been satisfied by any of the answers I put forth tonight. The point is that it has been grappled with by rabbis, by thinkers, by philosophers over the millennia. They've come to different conclusions, some of which are satisfying for various reasons or not satisfying for various reasons. But the fact that we continuously grapple with these issues and we don't simply say, that's it, is a very important thing and very reassuring to many. And for many, that is enough of a reason to remain within the fold, even if you still have your questions, because there's always time to keep discussing it, and hopefully we'll have more time to do that together. Okay, and now just to close, just want to thank everybody for coming out for tonight's lecture. I want to point out that next week we're going to be discussing men and women, meaning when the roles are different and why that upsets people, and ways you can resolve that. We'll discuss which ones are more of a sociological construct versus woman constructs and issues, which is an important distinction to be made. As well as other things. If you have any particular questions in that regard that you want to ask, please, if you want me to make sure to address it, tell me in advance. I can do an off-the-cuff answer, but if you want to answer with an actual source, that requires you to tell me earlier. And also, I mentioned that that next week we'll be having a day of giving for the Beit Midrash. You will, if you check the bottom of your emails for me, you'll be seeing it. Or again, you can find it on CrossMatch BMTD. And yeah, so if everybody has it.
What does language barrier focus on?
So language barrier will focus on why particularly things are done in Hebrew, as well as other ritualistic issues. If there's any particular ones that bother them, like related to, you know, use of Hebrew specifically, or other things related to ritual barrier, they'll be going there. I suppose in primarily language, because that also often bothers people. Like, why are we so beholden to Hebrew? Like, why? So that was my initial thought. Again, that part's not expressly addressed as much by my grandfather. I just thought that was one that would be useful, because I find that to be the language barrier, ritual barrier is a primary barrier, but that one's not specific to that's specific to every religion also, so it's not necessarily Judaism specific, so that's why I put it last. Because a lot of times the question of what ritual is and does make sense or not comes up in various shapes or forms.
So if I could, this was maybe it's the same thing as Shabbat, but I was looking it up, so I had a feeling. So it's talking about ordination. So it said in 2014, like, of the people who, not trying to people who say I want to donate a kidney to my brother, but I'm just stopped donating a kidney to somebody, a live organ donation. It said that Hasidim make up 0.2% of the American population, 0.2%. However, they donated 17% of all live kidneys, the Hasidim, to people who they didn't know. But of all those thousands of kidneys, only one went to a non-Jew.
So that's a separate, I mean, the generally...
No, it's the same thing. I don't want to open my body and put my kidney in a non-Jew's body.
So, yes, that is related, but let's also remember that generally most donations of kidneys are done to those people that you know.
No, this is...
Meaning...
These are other people who you don't know.
That's why I'm saying, in general, assuming we're not Iran, which actually is a market that you can sell your kidney for money. Well, that's a good thing or a bad thing. There's a separate point, not going to get into it. But the idea is that generally most people donate to people that they know. So the driving force behind them wanting to donate to begin with is the religious aspect and thought behind it. So if it wasn't for the fact that there was the religious aspect, they would have the same donation rate as everybody else. So it makes sense. As in, you're more likely to donate to, let's say, to a relative than you are donating to a random stranger. And the fact that they view their family being larger as a result of their religion is an overall positive. Yes, it's wondering why is it stopped there, but with the reason why you're more likely to donate your kidney to your immediate family member as opposed to you would, let's say, to somebody who is farther out than that, which is an example of where you're literally giving a great, great personal risk donating. And also, I do know many rabbi people who have donated kidneys to people who are not Jewish. Wow. So that's why, as in, like, misleading statistics are bad, and therefore we'll leave the issue of organization in a separate category, because that's a lot of other complicated things in regards to it as well. That, yes.
But also, you know, how you get so-and-so needs a kidney. So maybe they don't know them, but it's someone where there was a special request for a certain, you know, because they're Jewish.
Correct. Generally, for people to do things, example from donating blood. So the question is, so why don't they simply pay you to get blood? Wouldn't that solve all of our blood shortage problems? So the data shows actually that the inverse is true. That if you actually, that more people donate when it's viewed as being an act of good than being a financial benefit. So any of they give you like free cookies or, you know, whatever, like, you know, just gift cards are not really the reason and have actually no statistical effect on it overall. Generally, the main thing that gets people donating blood is because they feel morally obligated to do so. So therefore, kidneys might be an extreme example, because that's way riskier. You only do that once. But let's say, for instance, donation of blood is one that the morality is the primary driving force, not monetary. And therefore, that's an example of where the moral desire very much trumps. And that's why I would use that as a better example.
Thank you.